My name is Adil Raja, and currently I'm an investigative journalist, freelance journalist. I'm a member of the National Union of Journalists, and that wasn't my first career. I was initially after, once I was a youngster, I joined the Pakistani military as an officer. And that was a career of choice because my dad was in the army, my granddad was in the Royal Indian Army. He fought the Second World War, and my great granddad was also in the army, the Royal Indian Army. In fact, he was the one who refused to fight the Ottoman Empire as part of the Royal Indian Army. So he was sentenced to life imprisonment in this island, which is we call the Kalapani. But he was brought back because then we belonged to a warrior tribe, and a lot of the British Royal Indian Army consisted of my tribe, that is the Chib Rajput tribe. So the elders of the tribe went to the Viceroy at New Delhi and told them that, listen, if you're not going to get Sardar Niyaz Ali Khan back, and he was at that time, he was the highest ranking officer, which was accorded to the natives, and that was not a commissioned officer for sure. But the elders said that if he's not brought back from life imprisonment at this godforsaken island near Myanmar, so nobody from our tribe would join the king's army. So, the Royal Indian Army that was. So he was brought back from.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean the context of this is, was he being asked to fight over in Palestine because that's where one of the places the British were fighting with the Ottoman Empire, isn't it, or the Turks?
That's correct, actually. Yeah. So he refused alongside a large majority of people in the Muslim natives in the Royal Indian Army at that time. So, he refused to fight, and so that's why he was, charged with treason and sent for life imprisonment. But he was brought back and reinstated as the leader of his tribe, and that was a history that was before partition of Indian Pakistan. So I'm just trying to give you a bit of a history. My grandfather was a colonel in the Royal Indian, I mean, he was a lieutenant in the Royal Indian Army, and once he chose to join Pakistan because after the partition, the ancestral areas became part of Pakistan. So he naturally joined the Pakistan Army. And he rose to the rank of a colonel, and he was commanding a infantry battalion in the 1971 India-Pakistan War in the East Pakistan, which later on became current-day Bangladesh. And he remained a prisoner of war in India for 4 years, and he came back, and he was so disheartened and disillusioned that he just simply left the military, and he migrated to Canada.
Well,
And we're
this is
talking about
what the
1975.
British do. I'm afraid the British Empire was rather a naughty in doing this all over the place. Was okay, you've helped us during the Second World War, and now we're going to get the natives of India and Pakistan fighting each other.
Well, Tony, there is no denying the fact that the colonial legacy felt, left behind global fault lines, which are keeping current-day Britain relevant in global geopolitics. So, I mean, I cannot contest that. Nobody can contest that, actually. So, yeah, that is true. Kashmir, a point being, is one of the major flashpoint in that context. So, after my granddad left in 1975, by that time, my dad had already joined the Pakistan Army. And my mom married him, and my mom's entire family was in the UK, in London, Southwest London, actually. So she moved to there to marry my dad, and that is how the story went on. And I saw uniforms, and at that particular time, Tony, even after losing half the country, the uniform service was revered upon. I mean, that was really liked by Pakistanis. There was a lot of prestige involved in wearing a uniform and serving the country. Frankly and honestly, looking at the world now, I realized that the reason was that it was the best career option. There weren't many career options available in Pakistan other than wearing a uniform and becoming an army officer or join the civil services and be part of the colonial heritage. of left behind by the British Empire, and that is how it is still, going on. But I had that blood, which thought for themselves, and I had that warrior blood in me. So anyway, I joined in 1996. I joined the Pakistani military, served for 21 years in the with a fighting arm, took voluntarily retirement after I got injured, became a war wounded officer in the so-called war against terror, which I call, and many of my colleagues call, the war within. All right. So I got injured. I survived three IED attacks, one vehicle bomb suicide attack. So after all that, I decided to call it a day, and I thought I should start a second career. I was, and in 2016, I finally, after five continuous applications or resignations, my application for voluntary retirement was accepted, and I was, let go with full honors and awards, and I was brought on the reserve strength of the Pakistani Army till 2035, but. I became practically civilian, and I started my own business in Pakistan in the real estate sector. But I was more interested in becoming a journalist. I wanted to write, and I started writing in the English newspapers in Pakistani media, and I became a columnist. And
Well,
that
for those
because
that are
of that.
interested in following Pakistani affairs in English from England or from the English-speaking world, what are the main places to go to read Pakistani news in English?
Well, Tony, at the moment, actually, unfortunately, all the Pakistani media being published from Pakistan is being controlled and being muzzled. But I was writing for The Nation, that is an English mainstream daily of print media. Then I was also appearing in various English channels, PTV Global. Now, English is the official language of Pakistan ever since. Because it is a former British colony, and still English is the official language of Pakistan, although a second language. But well, if you need to write, if you need to read in English, but don't at the moment. I won't advise you to
Well, that's a
trust.
pity because I can remember maybe in the mid about sort of 2015 time reading paper copies circulating around in Bristol of a paper called The News, which was one of the best English language papers in the world.
Yeah, well, still the news still does publish, but the problem still remains. I mean, if it is being published from London, you'll find it of you'll find still you'll find it less adulterated. But if it is being published, I mean, they definitely are trying to maintain a reputation for themselves by allowing the voice of dissent to write. But what they write is heavily edited, and in my personal opinion, they are not allowed to do the independent journalism because of the atmosphere in Pakistan, because of the laws which have been passed recently, called the like PACA laws, and I mean, the laws are there designed to muzzle any kind of dissent, particularly if you are talking about those in power, and Pakistan is being ruled by the military from behind the shadows. It is a fact, not an opinion, but you're not allowed to criticize them. So if you're not allowed to criticize the Pakistani military, who are actually ruling the country, so what good is the kind of
Well, I mean,
journalism they're doing there?
you're bringing us a bit closer up to today with the or last decade with the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, the imprisonment of Imran Khan. Is that partly why you ended up having to stay here in the UK? Because you're a bit of a dissident in Pakistan.
Well, Tony, I was just, after retirement in 2016 and 2017, I started writing, and I became a notable journalist because at that time, nobody could buy the X, formerly Twitter, red, the blue tick. So you had to be a notable to get the blue tick. And as a journalist, I got that blue tick, and I was writing quite frequently. But I was supporting democracy, and I was supporting the national interest of Pakistan, which I could see was, in a democratic future for Pakistan. And I was supporting, of course, after Imran Khan came into power in 2018, and even before that, I was supporting him because in the creation of his the cancer hospital he created in the name of his mother through crowdfunding, and I supported him as a school kid in the crowdfunding. Of course, he was our cricketing hero. He brought us the only World Cup we have won in 1992. So once he joined politics, so I got interested, and a lot of youngsters in Pakistan got interested in politics for the first time, that listen, we've got some kind of hope in the shape of this party Imran Khan has brought forward. And the party actually was, excuse me, it was designed to promote accountability. And that is what was lacking in Pakistan, and justice. That is what was lacking in Pakistan, and a democracy on Westminster model, which was lacking in Pakistan. But well, he, but that really did not suit the Pakistani military junta, the generals, my people who were ruling the country. And at that time, I was the spokesperson of the Pakistani Ex-Servicemen Society as well. I'm talking about 2020 and 2022. So I was also running a media cell for the Pakistani Ex-Servicemen Society. I was working in close collaboration with the Pakistani military headquarters and Pakistani intelligence headquarters, because we were tasked with, controlling, spreading the military's point of view. And at that particular time, the military was on one page with Imran Khan, and they wanted to promote Imran Khan's ideals until it didn't suit them, until the accountability process, started questioning the generals. So that is where they thought, hold on, well, that's not what he wanted. Because the military in Pakistan, what we must understand, is not only a, like the military in the UK, it is running a 200 billion US dollar business empire. So they need to control the government in order to make favorable policies for
Well,
their own business.
what sort of businesses do the Pakistani generals own then?
Just name a business, they own it all, starting from shoemaking to banks to cement factories to oil businesses to sugar mills to food to livestock. Name any business, Tony.
We know
Just
it
name any
sounds
business.
a bit like the Egyptian model, where you've got a military who are really like an oligarchy now.
Yeah, that's correct, actually. So the Egyptian model is, it's replicating the Pakistani model in our history in Pakistan. Well, we've got a military dictator, a military president, Ayub Khan, starting from 1950 up to the mid 1960s. Then we had Zia-ul-Haq starting from late 1970s up till the late 1980s, a 10 year stint. Then we had General Musharraf, another 10 year stint. And now we've got another military, dictator, de facto ruler, Asim Munir, who wants to follow the footsteps of his, predecessors, and he wants to become the next 10 ruler who will rule for 10 years. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's fascinating. You've given us an amazing insight there into why Khan was imprisoned, why there was this judicial mugging of him. And in many ways, of course, the investors in these businesses won't even necessarily be Pakistanis. They may be Chinese, but they're more likely to be from the United States, who has also played this big role in Egypt in maneuvering things to put the military in charge of much of the industry and infrastructure there. Moving up a bit more closer to now, obviously you are going to come rubbing up against these people as a patriotic spokesperson for the Ex-Servicemen's Association. So how did all that go?
Yeah, well, that's why they can, that's where I got in trouble with them, because Imran Khan's regime change operation was something in which, Imran Khan's regime change operation was very carefully crafted. The military told him to go to Moscow to meet Putin on a state visit, and once Putin attacked Ukraine, Imran Khan was already in Moscow. So they told the military, traditionally aligned with the US deep state, told the Americans that listen, this guy, he's a fanatic, he cannot be controlled, he's already in Moscow, and Putin has attacked Putin has attacked Ukraine, and he was told to, cut short the visit and come back. He said, "Listen, I'm already here. I'm not coming back now. So I'm not going to support the invasion of Ukraine, but I'm already here." So that was very bad optics for Imran Khan, and that provided an opportunity to the Americans to write, to write a diplomatic cable called the Cipher. To the Pakistanis, that listen, he needs to be removed to removed from power, and he was removed from power in a vote of no confidence, allegedly orchestrated by the Pakistani military. And Imran Khan spoke about it in detail, and Imran Khan, made that secret cable cipher public as well. I mean, he didn't make it public, but he talked about it publicly, and then later on, it was reported widely in the media. So it was quite clear that the U.S. the U.S. government was involved in removing Imran Khan from power. I mean, who doesn't know that the Americans are involved in regime change
Well, they
operations?
certainly are. That is one of the things they love to do. But so, how come this landed right on your doorstep? How did that happen?
Yeah, so the army chief, in fact, boosted about removing Imran Khan from power in a meeting with the ex-servicemen, and I made that thing public. I made his admission public, and I said, "Well, yes, the Pakistani army chief, the most powerful man, General Bajwa, he has acknowledged in a meeting with the Pakistani ex-servicemen society that yes, speaking to the ex-servicemen, that yes, we have removed him from power because he was being a very naughty boy. He was not listening to us, and he was creating a lot of trouble for us. So yes, we have removed him." And he acknowledged, in his overconfidence, and once high on the power aid, you become so myopic that you can't look at the long-term consequences. So I made that admission public, and that became a cardinal sin. And then the Pakistani intelligence agencies started raiding my house, my mom's house, in fact, because my wife and kids were already here in the UK in London. And you've met Sabine, and how the things. So I was already a British resident. But they checked my passport. There was no visa on my passport. And being a resident, you don't need a visa, but all you need is a biometric resident permit at that time. So I had that permit on me. So I was traveling quite frequently I was shuttling between London and Islamabad. So there were two continuous raids on my house, and even before that, I was being reprimanded by the military headquarters. I was being called, and I was being told to shut up. But I didn't shut up. I started talking. I kept talking about it, and I kept writing about it. And that is what landed me in trouble because, Tony, I was told that I had a very good business going on in real estate worth around 4 million. Pounds worth, great British pounds actually. All my businesses were properties, and my bank accounts were seized, and I was warned that it will be seized if you do not stop talking in favor of
So,
democracy.
what did they accuse you of at that point? What was the legal reason to seize all your property? For telling the truth?
Yeah, of course. Imran Khan, listen, Tony, you need to understand, in Pakistan, Imran Khan, in his latest statement, said that in Pakistan there is no law but Asim law. What's Asim law? Asim is the military chief. There is no law in Pakistan. If the army chief is the law, if he says something, they make it happen. They make laws around it. I mean, the
So
army
they
chief's
probably wanted
desire.
to arrest you in Pakistan. How did you manage to get away to London?
Yeah, that's a very interesting story. So the first night they, came to arrest me with the. And the video went viral because my mom didn't open the door, and we were living, my mom being a widow of an army officer, living in a, army provide their own colonies, their own housing, estates to live in. And these are, I mean, very well protected as well. And all the military officers are living there. So that becomes, then a PR issue and an internal matter as well. But my mom didn't open the door of our apartment, and I was inside, and the video went viral actually, and they started live broadcasting it as well. So they didn't break in actually the first day. And even before that, I was being reprimanded on daily basis, and I was being warned that, listen, you are going to bear the consequences. The next day they came again, but by that time I was ready. And since I was this very successful businessman, I mean, 4 million might not sound a very big amount of money as for the in the UK, but in Pakistan it's big money, all right. So I had my own people, I had my own security guards, I had my own people working for me, and they were ready, in fact, waiting for my call. So I called them, and then I switched off my telephones because my mobile phones, because that is how they track your signals. I called them, and they all, in fact, gathered outside my house, and they tried to block them while I made an escape from the back door. And I had a car parked in the garage backside of the apartment. It was unregistered car. I drove myself, went to a relative's house. The same night I booked a ticket. In fact, I was already booked to come to the UK to meet my children and my wife 2 weeks after that raid, and it was Eid day. And I was booked at the Saudi Airlines business class. But I had to, the same night I booked the first available ticket, I still remember, one-way ticket of Qatar Airways cost me, almost the price of a return ticket of business class, but economy ticket, I got it. I got it from a friend and he bought it. So I had to pay him in cash so that, my details are not displayed on the system in case I'm being monitored. And before they could, send out an advisory to the airport, I directly reached the airport very early in the morning and I boarded the flight to Doha. By that time, my phones were switched off completely. My wife panicked. She made the news public. It was already public. She made the videos of the attack, the raid, public. So there was a lot of hue and cry in the Pakistani media. They started talking about it. But by the time the newspapers got published and the news of attack, the raid against me, the armed raid against me got public, I had left Pakistan. I was already on board, and I was already in Doha, Qatar.
Yeah, well, that must have been a nervous moment as you're getting onto the aircraft, hoping that the news has not got through from the military to stop you leaving the country.
Tony, this is very interesting. You're the first person, in fact, who could actually, who's asking me this question. And that's why I really like you, Tony. I don't want to, sound very appeasing of you, but you're a friend, of course. But yeah, nobody ever asked me the kind of stress it was there. I was continuously praying that, and I was really, my phones were on airplane mode. I couldn't talk to anyone and I was really worried. But there is an admission as well, Tony, that since I was very well connected and I still maintain, sources in the Pakistani intelligence community and the Pakistani military, I was helped at the airport to, get passed through immigration without a check. But the guy who was helping me out, the guy for immigration officer, he didn't know actually that why is he giving me this protocol, because he was asked by a friend who's a very highly placed friend, and later on he did get abducted by the intelligence services and he got court-martialed for facilitating my escape. In fact, the officer who helped me in the ISI, this is the first time I'm telling this to anyone, he got court-martialed for facilitating my escape. So he did facilitate it, and I did get passed through. At that time, they were not expecting me to just overnight leave because they were just trying to scare me off, because I was already a very notable journalist and they didn't want to, take me to task, as they would say. And but still, I was very careful, and I was helped by I was helped by different people, and as I told you. But even then, once I was sitting, I did go through all the checks, and my name wasn't flagged at that particular time. I was the first one who escaped the country, and all the checks came in after that. They placed an officer of the intelligence agency ISI at the airport after that. So I crossed the immigration, and there was around 40 to 50 minutes for me to board, and that was very intense moments, and I was praying, that nobody comes after me, and it has happened. They've got people offloaded from even while they're sitting in the plane. So till the time the plane didn't take off and left the Pakistani airspace, I was stressed
Yeah, and
beyond
then you could
belief.
breathe a sigh of relief, maybe even go into the toilet and have a cigarette or something, even though you're not supposed to do that. Look, anyway, you're now in London, but they are still pursuing you. But before you mention that, I wonder, could you say something about the operation of the intelligence service over there? The ISI is notorious, inter-services intelligence, and also the counterparts over in India, the RAW.
The ISI and RAW are fixated in a traditional India-Pakistan rivalry, which is a legacy of the British colonial rule. Once they left behind Kashmir issue unresolved and over that issue, Pakistan and India have fought three wars ever since 1947. In fact, now there are four because the latest one just like 2 months back, once the Pakistani army chief was his popularity was going down the drain, so he took refuge in India-Pakistan rivalry by ordering, as per my sources have written quite extensively about it, as per allegedly ordering a terrorist attack in the Indian administered Kashmir, which the Pakistanis like to call the Maqbooza Kashmir, or the Indians call the Pakistani side of Kashmir as Pakistan occupied Kashmir, and the Pakistanis call the Indian side of Kashmir as the Indian occupied Kashmir. So safe to say that, all right, that's the Indian side of Kashmir or Indian administered Kashmir. They orchestrated a terrorist attack, and they knew the reaction would come, and the reaction did come, and the Indians did attack Pakistan. But the Pakistanis were ready for that. They had already planned for that. With the Chinese support, they had advanced intelligence and high-tech intelligence through the Chinese, and Chinese weaponry was already ready, all right, to take them down, and they did take them down. Five of the Indian jets, they were downed, which is now public knowledge, and also the Indians, but in fact also Indians, freely targeted the entire breadth and width of Pakistan through their supersonic missiles, ballistic missiles. So, but Indian Pakistan, because there is a strategic deterrence in the shape of the nuclear weapons, the escalation ladder is always coordinated and controlled. The Director General of Military Operations of both the countries are always on the hotline. They're talking amongst each other, and they're saying that, listen, they are talking amongst each other, and they're controlling the escalation ladder. They're all right, this is what
But
is
you
going
know
on.
what fascinates me, I mean, I think many people in this country aren't aware that the close contacts between China and Pakistan, it's almost as if the world is dividing, into anti-Muslim and pro-Muslim countries with the United States as the anti-Muslim, pro-Zionist, and all other countries around the world are falling into this either one side of this. It's like almost like a cell dividing across the world, preparing for a bigger world war. But look, we haven't got much time, so please, can we just move to for you to talk about your case and how that went, and explain what how it is that the ISI can still pursue you here in London?
Yeah, well, Tony, first, the Pakistani state got me arrested on the counterterrorism under the UK's counterterrorism laws, and but they complained to the British government, and that I'm inciting violence in Pakistan, and they got me arrested. All the counterterrorism police, the Southeast
Well, hang
counterterrorism
on. Are
police.
you doing that? What were they saying you were up to?
Yeah, they said that I am, through my publications and through my transmissions and through my journalism, I'm inciting, I'm in the inciting violence abroad under the UK's
Okay,
counterterrorism
so
laws. They said
are
they
you trying to stir up an armed insurrection in Pakistan?
Well, Tommy, if I was, there was a 9 months inquiry that followed, while I was on bail. And when I was left the same, I was given a bail the same day, but I was kept on bail for 9 complete months. And after that, the case ended with a no further action and an informal apology from the police, the counterterrorism police, and they compensated me for one of the device, my computer, which they broke, and they paid me the price of a new computer. Very, very kind of them, actually. But I went through the 9 months of hell, and if I had been inciting violence, do you think they would have spared me, Tony?
No. So what about this latest case? Did you have to actually go to court yourself? Did you send a lawyer? The ISI have now turned up in London, apparently.
Yeah, so that's very interesting, Tony. In fact, today there has been a report of transnational repression, which has just, come out today, and it has been widely being reported. It was a parliamentary committee headed by Lord Elton, which has issued a report, and I was a witness in that. It says there is a rise in foreign states in silencing dissidents in the UK going unchecked. That's what they say, and that's not the only thing they're saying. In fact, Tony, in the report, they note that as well as pressing Interpol for action on abuse of red notices, the committee urged the government to provide more training on transnational repression for police officers in the UK and greater protection from vexatious lawsuits known as SLAPs, strategic lawsuits against public participation. So it was a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And in this report, primarily it was being, China and Russia or Iran was being, targeted, maybe. Targeted might not be the right word, but the focused. But the report notes that while the cross-party human rights committee said China, Russia and Iran were the most flagrant perpetrators of transnational repression in the UK, it highlighted evidence suggesting a string of other countries, including India, Rwanda, Pakistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain, had sought to target people in Britain. And I am the latest target. Last week, the trial, the Royal Court of Justice was a prime example of what this report is talking about. There was a case by a serving ISI's senior brigadier general, who was the commander of the biggest province of Pakistan, the Punjab, the sector commander of the internal wing. And I exposed not only him, but a lot of officers by name. That's why they really don't like me in Pakistan. That's why they court-martialed me in absentia, 8 years after retirement, announced a 14 years rigorous imprisonment sentence against me in Pakistan, seized all my properties, all my assets, all my bank accounts, abducted my mother in Pakistan, and she's now practically under house arrest. She's not allowed to leave the country. My family was tortured, and they've followed me to London through, and they harassed me through this strategic lawsuit against public participation, which went to a trial starting from 21st to 24th of
Okay,
July.
so what's the possible sanction on you? And what's their main accusation in this trial? We've only got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, Tony. Well, they're saying that I have exposed them and I have named the officer, so he's been defamed, and the judge now has to decide. And he's saying that either the judgment will come out this week or after the summer vacation. He now has to decide that whether the two things, whether there was any serious harm which did occur to the claimant, the Brigadier General, whether he had a reputation in the UK or not. That is for the judge to decide, because the burden of proof was on the claimant. And in my personal opinion, as the judge noted as well, there wasn't enough there. They couldn't provide that kind of opinion, and they were banking on the claimant-friendly UK libel laws, because of which, UK is called the libel tourism capital of the world. Geoffrey Robertson noted it in his book Lawfare.
Yes,
Anyway,
it certainly did. So
but the
are they
second thing,
looking to extradite you back to Pakistan or just get you to pay them?
No, Tony, they're looking. I can't pay them. I've got nothing. I've got no assets left. How can I pay them? But the judge has to decide now that whether he's going to grant me the privileged defense or not, whether I was a responsible journalist and whether my publications were made in public interest or not. Well, they were in public interest. There is no contention there. But whether my journalism was responsible or not, the judge has to decide that. And the National Union of Journalists is standing right behind me. And I really do. I'm thankful for journalists like you who are standing behind me. So that is what the judge has to decide now. So, there is no jury. The judge has to decide. And I'm hoping for the best result there.
Well, I think we're all kind of rooting. Well, we're all rooting for you. Ultimately, though, your country, it seems, is not acting in its own national interest. What's really going on?
Yeah, Tony, this is a very sad saga in which, this happens when the personal interests supersede the national interest of a country. And that is what's happening in Pakistan when Imran Khan, but he is being, wrongfully incarcerated, and there is a hybrid regime running the country. And well, there can't be any political stability
So,
with
I mean,
such a
is
hybrid
there any
regime.
chance for his
Till the time the people don't rise up, or till the time some international factors like his sons were in the US, they're lobbying for his release. So some international factors, they work around to move for his release, but Imran Khan himself is not interested. He has been offered many times through his near and dear ones to make some kind of a deal with the military, but he has refused to make a deal with
Yeah, well,
the
he won't sell out.
level.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
maybe you could just tell us how people can find and follow you online, and I'll leave you with a thought that maybe the British government is not acting in the British self-interest. So Pakistan isn't alone. How can people follow you, Adil?
Yeah, you can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at Soldier Speaks. All right. And you can find me, my work on my website, soldierspeaks.org. Soldierspeaks.org. If you go on my website, you're going to find all my socials. And my website is info@soldierspeaks.org.
Adil Raja, thanks very much for joining us, and the very best of British and Pakistani luck to you.
Thank you for having me, Tony.